All right, let's start off by just asking one of the first questions. In fact, it may have been the first question in our material. What is Isaiah frequently called? What is Isaiah frequently called? The Messianic prophet. And of course, the reason for that is because of how many references to the Messiah are found throughout the entirety of the book, which in chapter 40, we're going to look to two specific prophecies that were fulfilled, though not directly related to the Messiah himself, but in his kingdom, establishing his kingdom in the first few verses of chapter 40 today. What does the word Isaiah, or the name Isaiah, actually mean? Thank you, sir. Salvation is of the Lord, or the Lord is salvation, is the meaning of the term. Okay, question number two. How is Zion's present compared to Zion's future? What is the word that Brother Copeland used, or the phrase that he used to contrast the present at that point in time when Isaiah is prophesying, and the future that would come through the Messianic times? What do you call the present? Called it inglorious, didn't he? And contrasted with the glorious future. I just think that's an interesting contrast that is given for a couple of reasons. Number one, it indicates very clearly the reason for the chastisement and the judgments were coming because of the rebellion of Zion in this time, but also what God always reserved as a promise, which would be ultimately fulfilled in the Messianic kingdom, and to a degree that's very difficult for us to comprehend, but it would be indeed a glorious, glorious future. One of the texts that we have is Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 8 that indicates a Messianic prophet. And so when God asked, not chapter 6 and 8, it's 9, 6, but that's the next question. In chapter 6, 8, God asked, who shall I send? Who will go for us? And what was the famous response of Isaiah in that case? Here am I, send me. Yeah, I just love that as well. The idea. We should have that same willingness whenever opportunities arise to preach the gospel and to share with others. This idea of being too reserved or too afraid is something that wasn't present in Isaiah's life and serves as a wonderful example for us. He was bold. And you'll remember that God promised that he would have to do it through his entire life, and primarily he would be rejected in his teaching. They would still be rebellious. The chastisement would still be necessary, even though God warned about it again and again, but still Isaiah was committed to the task. Then we go to chapter 9 and verse 6, where God promised ultimately salvation through a born child. Which, of course, we understand is a messianic prophecy in chapter 9 and verse 6. What would the child be called as related in chapter 9 and verse 6? What are the words that are used to describe him? Everlasting Father is one of them. Exactly right, which again indicates that he is divine and one with his Father in heaven. What else? Mighty God and wonderful counselor. And also Prince of Peace, which of course is a well-known sobriquet of Jesus today. It is one that he is said to be time and time again, Prince of Peace. It's a beautiful thing. So that gets us through those four questions. Just wanted to kind of go back a little while and look at those and not forget them, because they're important things as we look through the book of Isaiah. I want to start here with some new material for this week. But first, before we do that, I want to go back and do a little bit or a quick review, just make 4 points, and then we'll go on, or 3 points. We're ending the Assyrian period here in this chapter. We told you that the section that deals with the Assyrians is chapter 1 through chapter 39. Then chapters 40 through 66 deal with the Babylonian period. And what we talked about last week was the defeat of Assyria by the Lord when King Sennacherib and his troops, there were 185,000 of them, were killed overnight as they surrounded Jerusalem. We read from 2 Kings chapter 19 and verse 25 about that, leading to Sennacherib to go back to his own country and never trouble Judah, Jerusalem again, and just a few short years later, his sons actually killed him. And then we started, and this is where chapter 38 actually begins, is the sickness of Hezekiah. And we talk mainly about that at the end of our time together, that Hezekiah became ill even to the point of death, and he was told by Isaiah that he would die. But he prayed to God fervently, and as a result of his fervent prayers, God relented in that regard, moved God to give him 15 more years to live. Now, what we had not addressed is the text from verses 16 through 20 of Isaiah chapter 38. So this is following King Hezekiah's recovery from what was a life-threatening illness, what would be regarded and what would seem to all who saw him as being a terminal illness. It was something that was so remarkable, you'll remember, that the Babylonians heard of it and came to him, sent emissaries to him. But I want to just read verses 16 through 20 of Isaiah 38 as you see a song, a poem that is written by Hezekiah describing his illness and his deliverance by Jehovah. I think it's a beautiful passage of Scripture. He said in verse 16, O Lord, by these things men live, and in all these things is the life of my spirit, so you will restore me and make me live. Indeed, it was for my own peace that I had great bitterness, but you have lovingly delivered my soul from the pit of corruption. You have cast all my sins behind your back. For the grave cannot thank you, death cannot praise you, those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your truth. The living man, he shall praise you as I do this day. The Father shall make known your truth to the children. The Lord was ready to save me. Therefore, we will sing my songs with stringed instruments all the days of our life in the house of the Lord. And I just wanted to bring that up just to note his thanksgiving, how much this was appreciated, the recognition, of course, that he had, because it had been told this was God's work. Wasn't the poultice figs. It was the work of God that he had been spared and given 15 more years of life, and he was truly thankful of these things and indicated that he would be thankful and express his thanksgiving from that point on. I just want us to be mindful of that, because I think that there are certain aspects of every one of our lives where we can say, okay, God helped me through this, and as a result of him helping me through this, I'm going to give thanks to God all of my life. Now, I know that y'all probably have been watching the television quite a bit yesterday and maybe this morning before you came with regard to the shooting of former President Trump and how narrowly he escaped. And what I thought was kind of interesting is how many times, at least on Fox News, because I first wanted to go to MSNBC and see what they would say about it, and then I went back to Fox, but so many of the Fox contributors attributed it to God's providence. That he was spared, indicating that this is a man ordained of God. In other words, God spared him because that's what we need. And that's speculative, of course, on the part of these individuals. The narcissistic man that Trump is, I don't know if God had a part to play in it or not. If God wants Trump to be the leader. But it is an interesting thing that while they reject God and forget God through all these times, this thing happened, a close miss, if it were, and God's providence is something that they make note of. How long will the Thanksgiving last is what I want to know in this regard. Hezekiah, it's not merely a speculation with regard to God's providence. We don't know how God works because we don't have revelation, but here we have the revelation of God with regard to Hezekiah's life, and we know that the reason Hezekiah was spared for 15 years was because God spared him. And again, we understand with God's provision and what God allows and those kinds of things. We just don't have the surety that Hezekiah had with regard to God's revelation to man. We do know God works providentially. And we do know that he works in our lives providentially. We may not know for certain every single time that this comes about because God is the one that directed it. But we always give God thanks for our lives, for the benefit of our lives, for the good things that happen to us, for prayers that are answered, and specifically good things that happen in our lives, because ultimately God is the one who gives us all the spiritual blessings in the heavenly places, and we need to be aware of that, and Hezekiah certainly was on this occasion. I think it's just a kind of an interesting example that we have here in this text. Okay, anybody have any comments they want to make before we go on? All right, then I want you to note that we get to, actually it's the second point. I'm not sure if I've got these, I got these in mind. So we're in the second point there on the slide, and that is that the king of Babylon hears about Hezekiah's healing. He sends a delegation to him. You'll notice in Isaiah 39, first two verses, a delegation comes, and Hezekiah, he just got out from under the hand of the Assyrians, but boy, life is good now, I'm living. And these guys say, boy, we're glad you're living. He comes in and he shows them everything. He shows them everything in his kingdom. That wasn't a wise thing to do. We can certainly see that that's the case. But it seems like, with regard to the admonition given by Isaiah, that it was actually something that displeased God. So let's notice in chapter 39 and verse 1. At that time, Merodach-Baladan, who was the son of Baladan, the king of Babylon, he sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he heard that he had been sick and had recovered. And Hezekiah was pleased with them. So he sent letters. That they didn't have the same kind of delivery system we have. So emissaries came from Babylon with these letters from the son of the king. And this pleased Hezekiah. You can see his pride, possibly his ego being stroked on this occasion. He was pleased with them and showed them the house of his treasures, the silver and the gold, the spices, the precious ointment, all of his armory, all that was found among his treasures. And there was nothing in his house or in all his dominion that Hezekiah did not show them. Well, that brought Isaiah to come to him and to remonstrate with him for what he had done. So Isaiah told the king, the time's going to come when all of the treasures and his sons would be carried away to Babylon. Notice verses 5 through 8. Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord of hosts. This is not just Isaiah. These are the words God gave him. He said, behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house, what your fathers have accumulated until this day, shall be carried to Babylon, and nothing shall be left, says the Lord. They shall take away some of your sons who will descend from you, whom you will beget. They shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. So Hezekiah said to Isaiah, the word of the Lord which you have spoken is good. For he said, at least there will be peace and truth in my days. Now, that's kind of an interesting response, isn't it? So this is a pretty strong admonition and a pretty strong indication that because of what Hezekiah did, or at least in part because of that, all of these precious things that he showed would be taken away, and even his sons, who he would beget, would become eunuchs in Babylon for the king. So the question I had, and I did some study on this, is why did Hezekiah respond like that? He said, the word of the Lord you've spoken is good. And there's actually an exclamation point, although that's supplied by the translators here in the New King James Version. And then he says, at least there will be peace and truth in my days. And he asked, well, why did Hezekiah respond as he did? And I want to discuss this just for a moment, but I would like to begin by just noting that I really appreciated what Albert Barnes had to say on this in his commentary. And I want to look at the four points that he made. The first one is the fact that he saw that it was just. The word of the Lord is good. In other words, this admonition that came was recognized by Hezekiah as being a just admonition. So the word of the Lord is good is not merely saying, boy, these are great, but rather it was an acknowledgement that he had indeed done wrong. It was an acceptance of the guilt of his sin. He felt that he had sinned. He had made an improper display of his treasures, his ego and his pride had gotten in the way, and he deserved to be punished. But there are a couple of other things. First of all, maybe Hezekiah felt that the punishment was rather mild and rather merciful. He had been given 15 more years. This could have been taken away. They could have been taken away into captivity immediately, but God had allowed for this to happen at some point in the future. So maybe Hezekiah thought that was less than what he actually deserved and what he had reason to expect, and he was appreciative of God's mercy, which is the third point. It was merciful to him. It was merciful to his kingdom at that time. God wasn't coming immediately to cut him off. And so his life, the fourth point, which would be a little bit of self I'm not saying self-preservation, but an appreciation of the fact that he's directly not going to suffer from it, at least in my days. Now, maybe that would be a somewhat inappropriate response, but there would be relief that was expressed honestly that his own reign and life were to be full of mercy until his death. I mean, just a peculiar way of it being put here in this particular text. So this is, Babylon's coming, they're going to take you, they're going to take your kids. Oh, this is a good thing that the Lord is saying. You know, why was the word stated in that way? And I thought that Albert Barnes' 4 points there was something that kind of covered that fairly well. Anybody have any things, any points they want to make in disagreement, any discussion? Yes, Albert. That's an interesting question, because there are a couple of times when the question comes, did Isaiah just respond because he learned of a circumstance? And I think that that's very possible. It certainly is possible that that can happen. In this particular case, though, we are told that it is after King Hezekiah did, Isaiah the prophet went to him and said to him, "What did the men say, and from where did they come to you?" I think he probably knew that. In other words, it would be kind of like Jehovah God in the beginning, in the Genesis account, when Adam and Eve hid. "Where are you, Adam?" He knew where he was, and he knew what he had done. But he elicited that response from them. And so it's hard to say for a certainty. Regardless, there was some indication, possibly, that Isaiah had that something wrong was happening, and it may not have been fully revealed to him. It may have been that now the word of the Lord came and said this. You tell Hezekiah this right at that point in time. It's really not something that's clear. I just feel like, since God knows, that probably Hezekiah knew as well as a result of these things, because he specifically asked that question. And Jesus did that from time to time, knowing their hearts. He would still ask the question to elicit either a truth or an untruth from him. Anybody else? All right, then let us go on, because this ends basically the first section of the prophecy of Isaiah, as we indicated. The second section, it says at the end of this summary, it contains prophecies designed to comfort the people of God when they found themselves in Babylonian captivity. So we've already talked about the Assyrians coming, taking Israel, but God sparing Judah. And all of the things that surrounded this. This was during the life of Isaiah the prophet. But the last 26 chapters, chapters 40 through 66, now we're going into the Babylonian times and our discussion of these things. And so I want to just give you some review questions very closely, or very quickly, for this section, and then we'll get into new material. So again, using the material that we have in Mark Copeland's book on Isaiah, what is the theme of the chapters here in chapters 36 through 39? What is the title of the lesson? A historical interlude. So this is a transition period that we're talking about with regard to the end of the Assyrians, what happened with Hezekiah, the promise of what is to come, an interlude between the two. Going back just a little bit to chapter 36 and verse 1, what was the name of the king of Assyria that came and laid siege to Jerusalem? Well, the king, though, was Sennacherib. But yeah, his, and that was another thing that we talked about and emphasized. He sent his cupbearer, or his right-hand man, who is referred to as the Rabshakeh, to make the threats against Jerusalem that were made. So that Rabshakeh, this is question number 10. What did he utter as he concluded his message to the Jews on this occasion? Okay, not to trust the Lord. Remember, he had been defeating other gods up to that point in time, not realizing who he was coming up against this time. And as such, he had confidence that he would still have the ability to overcome Israel. But this was something that no doubt would have In fact, this is why they said, don't talk to the people. Just talk to us about this. And Rabbi Shechem proclaimed it to the people so they could hear him, that don't trust Hezekiah and don't trust what he has to say about the Lord. So what did Hezekiah do? Chapter 37, verses 1 through 4. He was a good king. What did he do? He was worried because Assyria had done just what the Rabbi Shechem had said. He sent for Isaiah, didn't he? Verses 1 through 4 of Isaiah 37. He wanted to know what the prophet Isaiah had about that, and Isaiah assured him that indeed that he would be spared. The representatives, this is question 12, the representatives were told about the threats of the king of Assyria. They were told not to be afraid, for the Lord would cause him to return and fall in his own land, which we know that that would indeed happen. See here. Let's go down to verse question 18s, unless I made a mistake in the copy and pasting. I don't think I did. So the second question 18 in the questions: what happened about the time that, or the next in the narrative following the death of the king? The death of the king, and let me rephrase that. The going away of Sennacherib and the death of the 185,000, because again, his death actually came a bit later. But it's the last thing that is mentioned there in the text before we get into chapter 38 and the first verse. What's going to happen? Or what did happen there? Okay. The illness of Hezekiah. He was told to prepare for his death. And what did he do, as indicated in question 19, in order to avoid it? Only one way to avoid that death, wasn't it? What was it? Pray to God. Okay, so he prayed to God fervently. And then I just want you to be reminded in question number 20, the sign that was given to the king that he would be healed. He didn't expect a sign, didn't necessarily want a sign, but God was going to demonstrate that this was from him, lest it be denied. So what was that sign? Okay, so the shadow on the sundial going back 10 degrees, which again we know must have been supernatural. Remember that we talked last time about, I don't know whether King Hezekiah's healing was miraculous or merely providential, but I do know that the sign, which is what a miracle typically is for, is to produce a sign bringing faith or acknowledgement that God is behind it. The sign was indeed miraculous because it was not possible for the shadow to regress without God's supernatural intervention, setting aside the laws of nature to accomplish that work. We know that envoys came with letter and gifts from Merodach-Baladan, the son of the king. What did Hezekiah show them? Show the emissaries. Okay, everything. That's good. That's question number 24. And then the last one, question 25, what did Isaiah tell Hezekiah would happen as a result? It would be taken away. Not in his lifetime, but it would be taken away. So that gets us really to chapter 40 now, where we're going to be discussing the new material as we get into the 40th chapter. So if you will, turn there. And just want to note a couple of things as we get into this. First of all, if you look at the objectives in studying this section in Lesson 9, the One True God versus Idols, chapters 40 and 40 through 48, the objectives, the first one is to see how God used Isaiah to comfort to a generation of Israel long after Isaiah's death. So, just so that you understand, Isaiah wrote this, that these things were going to happen in Isaiah 40 through 66, and he died before they actually started happening. Because as you go back to the history, both of when it was said that Isaiah lived and he prophesied, the events which happened here followed that. I'll take you back to page 3 of the outline and just read one paragraph to that, where the duration of Isaiah's life is explained under Isaiah the man. So if you want to go back, you can read along with me, but it says, it's generally thought that the vision of the throne scene, which occurred in the year Uzziah died, in Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 1, was the beginning point of his ministry as a prophet. And that is approximately 739 BC. According to Jewish tradition, Isaiah was executed by Manasseh. So he was the next king following King Hezekiah. So it is seen that Isaiah prophesied through the entirety of Hezekiah's reign, but either died toward the end of that, died at the end of it, when Hezekiah died, or perhaps for a short period of time into the next king's reign, not prophesying necessarily at that time because it's not mentioned, but being killed by Manasseh. There are a number of traditions as to what happened. The one that is most popular, perhaps the most grievous, is that he was sawn in half with a wooden saw on that occasion. And this would mean that Isaiah prophesied during a period of approximately 50 to 70 years. I heard 74 when I was looking at other commentaries, or one other commentary would be how long it was. This comment from Copeland says about 50 years from 739 to 690 B.C. We don't know exactly how long it was that he prophesied, but the events which transpire in these final 26 chapters took place after Isaiah died. So this is all, again, an indication of just how relevant Isaiah's preaching was, and how God was with him, and that the things that he said would happen, didn't have to modify them after he died, because just as he said it would happen is the way that it happened. We get into chapter 40. First, let's look at the last two objectives here. We consider the challenge made to the nations of men and their idols, which proves the existence and identity of the one true God, and then to note the prophetic references that were fulfilled in the coming of Christ. So chapter 40 does two of those things very, very clearly, when we find in the first half of chapter 40 two prophetic references to the Messianic kingdom that we want to address, we want to talk about. And then the third section, which begins, I think, in verse 9 of the text and goes down through verse 31, there is a wonderful description of the preeminence and the power of God. And when you consider, it's very much like the Apostle Paul did to the Athenians in Acts chapter 17. You've got all of these you're very religious, you've got all of these gods that you worship. There's this God for this thing, this God for that thing, this God for the other thing. But the one true God, the unknown God, he's the one I'm going to declare to you. And when that God is declared, it's just such a grand departure from the mindset of the men who created their own gods, who he was, the preeminent and powerful one. It's a problem that the king of Assyria didn't understand. It's the problem that the king of Babylon didn't understand. And in fact, it has been in every secular nation. They ally themselves. The Egyptians did it. The Romans did it. Where they'll even get to the point, you may remember, in about AD 96, with regard to the reign of Domitian, that he declared himself as a god. The individuals who did not worship Domitian, the emperor of Rome, the Romans considered them to be atheists. You don't believe in God because you don't believe Domitian is a god. There's this man in front of you. And the Almighty God of heaven, he declares himself as the preeminent one, the one true God in these verses. And we'll read some of them for your consideration, because I think it is a wonderful expression of that. But we now begin that new section, chapters 40 through 66. And one of the things to note is that the final chapters of Isaiah are intensely messianic. We've talked about the messianic nature of prophecy, him being the messianic prophet. When we get into these chapters, chapter 40 here, chapter 53, 55, 61, all of these things are specifically fulfilled in the New Testament and are referenced to where you can go and you can see the fulfillment of them. The New Testament writer saying this is that, this is what was spoken of, or this is what that meant, so we can have some realizations. We're going to see this a little bit in verses 3 and 4 and 6 and 8 in just a few moments' time. So the first thing in the summary, if you'll notice, is Isaiah not living. The second thing is in chapters 40 through 48, you'll note that in that first paragraph, there's a recurring theme, the challenge that the God of Israel makes to idols and those who worship them to prove their existence by proclaiming what shall happen and then bringing it to pass. And so we're going to go through this kind of chapter. The idols are are impotent. The idols are not truly existent deities, but boy, God does exist. And this is what is going to happen, and it's going to happen because God said it was going to happen, and God's power brings that to pass. So we're going to be discussing this. We'll start off with verse 9 of chapter 40, but it's something we're going to be discussing in the next study following this one today as we talk about chapters 40 through 48. But chapter 40 kind of serves here, he says, in the summary, as a prologue, offering comfort and assurance. The fulfillment ultimately of this is going to be in the Messianic kingdom, but I want you to note what is stated in chapter 40 and verses 1 through 2. Chapters 40, 1 through 2. So here's this purpose, this prologue, this preface that is stated here, is so that the people will know, yes, this Babylonian captivity is going to happen, as was prophesied to Hezekiah, but it's going to come to an end, and God is going to bless his people. So notice what is said in verses 1 and 2. Comfort ye my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, and that she has received of Jehovah's hand double for all of her sins. Okay? So this is a declaration that the people should be comforted with regard to this. Now, when would the comfort start? Well, I would say to you that it was not something that started, the comfort that started during the captivity, but it would be something that really took place, prophets and their purposes all the way to John the Baptist and the Messianic prophecies coming, the Messiah himself, from the time of the remnant returning for Babylonian captivity into the kingdom is established. There is that comfort because the ultimate fulfillment of this, as indicated in these two verses, when Jehovah had finished the punishment, that they had received double for all their sins, but the warfare is accomplished, the iniquity is pardoned, that really didn't have its fulfillment until the Messianic kingdom. There was a way in which it was fulfilled in the sense of the remnant returning, but there was still conflict, and certainly there was still rebelliousness, and nothing was ultimately completed until the coming of the Messianic kingdom. I truly believe that starting with verse 1 and going down through verse 6 of the text, verse 8 of the text, we have references specifically to what was ultimately fulfilled in the Messianic kingdom, beginning with these first two verses. Okay? Questions, comments? Anything you want to add to the first two verses of the text? All right, well then let us look at verses 3 and 4, and then we'll look at verses 6 through 8. Maybe we'll have time to get into the ninth verse, but we'll see how long it takes. So this first passage in Isaiah 40, in verses 3 through 4, is one that we have heard time and again. Notice he says in verse 3, and excuse me, when I was taking the notes, I accidentally changed my translation to the American Standard Version. And I thought I'd changed it all back to the New King James, but it's obvious that I didn't. I'm not using the cryeth, I use the cries. But this is the American Standard we're reading from in Isaiah 43 through 4. The voice of one that crieth, prepare ye in the wilderness the way of Jehovah, make level in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the uneven shall be made level, and the rough places the plain. We referred to that, did we not, in Wednesday night study. I think it was less than 5 2 weeks ago, if I remember right. It may have been less than 4 3 weeks ago. But we talked about John the Baptist in the booklet, or the book, that Dennis is doing a fine job of teaching on Wednesday evening. This is the one of the verses that we referred to. The verses concerning the coming of Elijah, or the coming of one to make the paths straight. We are told, for example, in Matthew chapter 3 and verse 1 through 3, notice this as a fulfillment of the prophecy of John the Baptist. Matthew 3, 1 through 3, there is a direct quotation of what was found in the verses we just read. In those days comes John the Baptist, preaching in the wilderness of Judea, saying, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. For this is he that was spoken of through Isaiah the prophet, saying, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, make ye ready the way of the Lord, make his paths straight. And so we see from that as noted in our Wednesday night study, it was John's purpose to prepare the way of the Lord, to even everything out, to level it out, to make it easier for Jesus to do His work for the fulfillment of the kingdom. And we know that John the Baptist did so without ego. He did so with that declaration, as there is one coming who is mightier than I, whose sandal I am not worthy of latching. He said that that the Messiah was one who was greater. He must increase and I must decrease. And eventually he even lost his life as he was beheaded in Herod's prison. Now, all of these things happened, and yet his work was a grand work. I think that it's interesting about what Jesus had to say about John the Baptist. He said, there is not one greater than John the Baptist that is born among, is it among men or among women? I can't remember what the exact phrase was. We're talking about, with regard to the birth of John the Baptist, as a human, there was nobody better than John the Baptist. Now, he did say, but he was, at least in the kingdom of heaven, greater than John, because John lived and died before the kingdom was established. But as far as his ministry, as far as the importance of the work that John the Baptist did, there was nothing that was exceeding that work that John did. He was truly a righteous individual and accomplished what he intended to do. So that's one thing about the Messianic kingdom, not directly about the Messiah. This is about John the Baptist. And we're told in Matthew chapter 3 that he fulfilled it. All right, questions, comments? Okay, then let us get, and I'm sorry, my notes kind of went out here, so let's go, I'll just have to do this by memory a little bit. Let's go to verse 6 through 8 of chapter 40. There is another voice that cries out. He said, "What shall I cry? All flesh is grass. All its loveliness is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades, because the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people are grass, the grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever." That's such a wonderful declaration. When it says the word of our God stands forever, to what does the prophet here in Isaiah 6 through 8, to what does he refer? Anybody? Gospel. Let's go over to 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 1, where again we have a direct fulfillment of this that is given in chapter 1 and verses 22 through 25. If you will, read along with me. The Apostle Peter says this, "Since you have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit in sincere love of the brethren, love one another fervently with a pure heart, having been born again, not of corruptible seed, but incorruptible, through the word of God which abides and lives forever, because," here is the quotation, "all flesh is as grass, all the glory of man is the flower of the grass withers and the flower falls away, but the word of the Lord endures forever." Then he says, the latter part of verse 29, "Now this is the word which by the gospel was preached to you." Okay? So again, the ultimate fulfillment of what Isaiah is saying here in Isaiah chapter 40, verses 6 through 8, is accomplished with regard to the Messianic kingdom and the Messianic word, the gospel of Jesus Christ. Do understand this. All that God has proclaimed is the truth. All that God has proclaimed is not the gospel. Do you recognize that? The old covenant served its purpose, but after its purpose was served and was accomplished, the old covenant passed away and the new covenant took its place. When it comes to salvation, when it comes to redemption, when it comes to the reality of these things, the word of our God stands or endures forever. It is the gospel of Jesus Christ that will never come to an end. Now this passage, just as a way of application, because we don't have time to get into verse 9, just want to make note of one thing. The Muslim religion says that God sent prophets into the world to give messages from time to time. And he sent Jesus. And so we recognize and we respect Jesus. But Jesus' will no longer holds, or what he had to say no longer holds the authority that now the prophet Muhammad does. Because he's the next prophet. He's the latest prophet of God. And he's the one that we need to listen to. You understand what Peter just said? What Peter said was, this is the one that will endure forever. And what the Hebrew writer said is that he spoke in times past by the fathers and the prophets, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. And just simply by noting those two things, that there is a full understanding of it, we can take issue with anyone who would ever declare that they have a new revelation from God. Because that's not God's plan. That's not God's scheme. It was his scheme that in the fulfillment of the Messianic kingdom and the preaching of the gospel, his word, his will, would not pass away. He last of all spoke by his Son. That's why Paul said, if we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel than that which is preached, let him be accursed. You see that? But the last words have been said. The words that will endure forever until Christ comes again have been spoken, and we're to listen to them and them alone. And anyone who has a new revelation from God, it's not from God. Because the gospel has once for all been delivered to the saints, and it is what we are to heed. All right? That gets us to the end of our time. Anybody have any questions or comments that you want to make about the first 8 verses of Isaiah 40 before you dismiss? All right, again, we are right at the end of our time together, so what I'll do is make note again of verses 9 through 31. Read some of those verses. We're not going to spend a great deal of time. I just want to emphasize what God has to say about his own preeminence and power. And then we'll get into chapters 41 and following of our particular text. We may spend another week, a little more than a week. I don't know how long it'll take to get through those 8 chapters. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today.